quite a few things that we weren't able to finish the other day, so as I have a free, quiet afternoon, I thought I'd have a go at finishing things off a bit. To go back to the capture of the Hanover with Ronald Mingy in the Assiniboine down the West Indies, I mentioned briefly my elder brother. He was some 6 years older than I and had served as a young seaman in World War I and took his time but was called back at the beginning of World War II and was sent to the Fleet Air Arm for some reason or other, although he was a torpedoman. And he had a pretty rough time because he was sunk in the Royal Oak up in Scapa Flow. Then later on, when I was in Ottawa with Rollo Minga, we were escorting a convoy across the Atlantic, and an armed merchant vessel, the Laurentic, was torpedoed not very far from us. And my brother was serving in there. I suppose she had one of these catapult aircraft or something. And I was on watch at the time when the signal came through and from the Admiralty to Mingy, who was senior officer of the of this particular escort. The Admiralty told him to send somebody to attend to try and rescue the survivors from Laurentic. And as I was on watch with him, I said, "Is there any chance we could go, sir?" I said, I have a brother serving in her." He said, "I'm sorry, Budger, but I'm the senior officer, and I have to stay with the convoy." He said, "But later on," he said, "I'll send a signal to the Admiralty and ask them if your brother is a survivor," which he did, and the message came back that leading seaman Budge was, in fact, a survivor. From there, he later on went to another ship. I'm just trying to think of the name of it now. But she was on the Avenger, I think it was. No, I can't think what ship it was, but he got torpedoed again in the... I met him in Edinburgh. He was at an air station just outside Edinburgh, and we'd gone into the Huron had gone into Leith for some repairs, and I arranged to meet my brother, and we had a run ashore in Edinburgh. And so he said, well, he was at Donnybristle, the air station fairly near. And he said, well, I'm going to see you again fairly soon. I said, gosh, I said, you've had your whack. So I said, well, where are you going? He said, I'm going to the Empire Audacity. Well, as you probably know, any captured vessels were always renamed Empire something. And previously in Ottawa, where I was with Mingy, and and on several occasions we ran across the Empire Audacity, which Hanover had been renamed. But since then she ran as a merchant vessel for some time, and then they converted her to a jeep carrier on the Gibraltar run. And he went in there, and so I said to him, I said, well, you be blasted careful of that ship. I said, you've been torpedoed twice. I said, we went to a great deal of trouble to capture that, and don't you get sunk in her. And damn it, he did. She was torpedoed on the Gibraltar run, but once again he got away. He said he got away in a pilot's dinghy and saved himself that way. So that was the end of the old the new Hanover, renamed Empire Audacity. And to finish off the saga of my brother, he was in the Adventure, again, a Jeep carrier that was involved in the North African landings, and she was torpedoed in her bomb room, and there were no survivors. So he had a rough war. Anyway, to go back to, I think I was last in the Ontario, heading for Guantanamo, where I was to be relieved by Duncan Raymond. Incidentally, you mentioned the engineer officer of Ontario, Bill Arneson, quite a character. Magnificent engineer with a fine sense of fun. And he knew I had a bit of an obsession for ice cream. And the ship was in Colon, where we'd come through the canal to engage in exercises with the destroyers down from Halifax, I think it was Nootka, with Hugh Pullen. And we were entertaining the destroyer officers on the quarterdeck, and old Armisen suddenly it's hot under the awnings, and there was a lull, and the steward walked in with a plate upon which was a beautiful looking scoop of ice cream, a huge scoop of ice cream, which looked like a fruit salad and syrup spread over the top. And he said, "With the compliments of the chief." And you know, I tried to get ice cream in Panama, but gosh, we couldn't stock it in the canteen in those days. And so I looked around to see where the chief was, to call down blessings of Allah upon his head and wonder how the heck he'd managed to accomplish this miracle. And I noticed that everybody was looking a bit, and I picked up the spoon alongside it and went to dig into this beautiful piece of ice cream, and damn it, it was made of plaster of Paris. We had a dentist on board, and old Bill Anderson had cooked this up along with the dentist. It was a good laugh. Anyway, we pursued it from the ship. After the exercises, went to Guantanamo, where Duncan Raymond came on board, and I got an aircraft to Miami, up to Boston, to Halifax, and finally to Cornwallis, which was to be reopened after some years because there was a need for greater facilities for new entry training, I think initiated by the Korean War. My captain, as you probably know, was Captain A.P. Musgrave. I'd never met him, except for a very brief few moments in Naden some years before, and what I heard was nothing good of him. You know, they gave him the reputation of a heavy drinker, and as a, you know, executive officer, your life was made miserable by being made to open the wardroom bar at all times, odd hours of the night, and I thought, well, this won't go well with me. But anyway, I was there in Cornwallis. At that time, he was up in Ottawa just trying to get things organized and underway. And I think this was so many appointments and jobs that I'd had in the Navy all seemed to point ultimately to Cornwallis. My original job as a Killick, as a reserve training, which I did a great deal of in Halifax in my early days, when I was a gunner in the Saguenay and subsequent ships, any reserve midshipman or sub-lieutenant was turned over to me. They kept watches with me, and I was required to instruct them. In addition, during the summer when the RMC cadets came down, they also came under my wing. I remember Bill Landimore was one of them. And I took a great interest, and I spent a lot of time working with them. And on one occasion, we had an officer who frequently came up for training during the war, a VR from Winnipeg, my Freya. And he was with us when I had a Willie Hayes was one of my cadets. I had a bunch of cadets, and we went down to New York. And during the period that Freya was with us, he observed the fact that and the manner in which I trained these people. And later on, he told me that he had written to Ottawa a personal letter that he had written, and he felt that the manner in which I carried out these duties deserved recognition. And, but I didn't know about this till some years afterwards. Anyway, this was my job at Cornwallis, and you remember Cornwallis. You were there one or two occasions, and it was a job I thoroughly enjoyed. I don't think I ever worked harder in my life, and my wife put in a good stint there because she entertained a great deal of officers from Halifax, and it was a good job. Anyway, Captain Muskie came along, and one of the first things he said to me, he saw that I wore gloves, and he said, "I see that you wear gloves, Budge." So I said, "Yes, sir, but I think you'll..." I said, "This was the way I was brought up as an officer." And I said, "But I think you'll find out that I'm not afraid to get my hands dirty." And I intended to start off the place in a fairly strict manner. And we had a group of... a bunch of petty officers drafted who arrived a couple of weeks before any new entries were due to arrive, and I really gave them the works. Because of the fact that at the end of the war most youngsters left the Navy, but anybody who had any rank at all and not prepared to go outside stayed in, and consequently we did have an excess of chief and petty officers, and in their home bases, Naden, Stadacona, they hadn't been required to do duty more than one in nine. Well, I decided that the whole of the establishment, everybody, would be in four watches, officers as well. I instituted all executive officers who were associated as divisional officers for the new entries, they would be in four watches and would carry out their duties related to new entries. In other words, they would, when they were at duty, they would stay in the vicinity of the new entry blocks and actually sleep in one of them. And similarly with the chief and petty officers. The executive petty officers, chiefs and petty officers, were all allocated to divisions. I tried to get a chief and a petty officer to each division of new entries. Sometimes it was just two petty officers. The remainder, supply people, anybody else, were required to carry out duties after silent hours as duty chief petty officer, duty petty officer, up at the main gate, where also the spare officers, the non-executive officers, schoolmasters, supply officers, anybody else, were also in watches, and the chief petty officers there were more or less to advise those officers without experience in such matters. In other words, we started off in a pretty strict manner. And a padre was Harry Plowman, the Protestant, an ex-seaman, Newfoundlander, very, very fine man. I thought a great deal of Harry Plowman. But they were so short of priests that they couldn't send us an RC priest. So, there was an RC church up not far from the main gate, but we had no Protestant church, so whilst one building was being converted into a church, we used the recreation space. And shortly after we started, all through my service career, I'd been associated with singing, Christmas carols and this sort of thing. And Captain Musgrave sent for me and he said, "Budge, start a choir." And I said, "Aye, aye, sir." And I started off with, in the very first week, with 14 ordinary seamen. And on Saturday mornings, which incidentally, everybody was required to work, because on that day we held ceremonial divisions, and up until 10:30, by which time everybody was sent to clean into number ones, everybody worked except the choir boys, and we would go with them to the church, and Mickey Noll, the bandmaster, bless his heart, he volunteered to play the organ, and which Captain Musgrave managed to acquire on tick, which was ultimately paid for by canteen funds. He was a great churchman, I found out, was Captain Musgrave. Anyway, we started off with this choir, and Mickey Noll was a great help. He taught me more about music and singing and conducting than I'd ever even thought I'd be capable of. And we had an organization called the Joining Group. When a division joined, much the same as when I joined as a boy seaman, we weren't required to participate in anything for the first 2 weeks on account of inoculations, medical examinations, dental work, and the fact that they hadn't been taught aid of march or salute. And they were more, and they had to be issued with their kit, and they had to get it marked and the name sewn in, as I had to as a youngster. And this all took time, and they were more or less kept in a separate building, the Joining Group, with a superb warrant officer, commissioned officer, Freddie Freeman, and a chief petty officer would nurse them and sort of initiate them into the service, by which time they would they'd be ready to associate with real people. And every Saturday morning, they were, the Joining Group were falling in as Protestants on the right, Catholics on the left. The Protestants were marched off to choir practice, as were the Catholics to their respective churches. Now, when I received this bunch from, I would make them sit in the front rows and just listen. And they'd watch the choir practice. Now, every time I went to a choir practice, I stopped being the commander, and to signify this, I took my coat off. And we practiced singing. Mind you, I wasn't an accomplished singer, really, and I wasn't very good at this business, and neither were they, but their enthusiasm was really and truly very effective, very, very enthusiastic and very catching. And for the whole time I was there, it worked very well. But to go back to Cappy Musgrave, I soon found out that his reputation was not the one that I had heard. I found him to be a magnificent Christian gentleman. Initially, Cornwallis had quite a large, during the war periods, had a large gradual organization to look after their transport. And there were just a couple left, mainly to drive the two cars which we were allocated. But they were skilled, and they had a almost a service station down in one of the areas, the Cornwallis. And the chiefs and petty officers found out about this. You know, they had all the equipment there, and they were sneaking down there and using it. And so Captain Musgrave felt this wasn't right, and he fell everybody in and said, "Look here, this is service equipment. You ought to keep away from it. You want to get your car serviced, you take him downtown." Well, that was fine. And then one day, an officer came up to me and he said, "Sir, the captain's having his car filled with freestone, with the antifreeze, down the garage." So I thought, well, a bit of a sneak, but I thought, well, damn it. You know, if he can have it, I can have it. So I walked around, and I did a bit of nosing around. And by gosh, he was having it filled. It was true. You can't expect the captain to run around and do his own filling up his car with antifreeze, and that's all they did. And it was purchased downtown. So, you know, this put the captain, to my mind, in a completely new light. You see, this officer felt that they'd heard the captain laying down the law, but he didn't obey his own law, but as far as I was concerned, he damn well did. And we had a splendid relationship the whole time we were there. And very quickly, it was noised abroad that we had a choir, and practically every Sunday, I don't know how my wife stood it on occasions, you know, we'd go off in a, we'd load the new entries in the choir into a bus, and I would take my own car, my wife and daughter. We'd go up to Bear River, Windsor, all the funny little churches around Cornwallis. And of course, the new entries loved it, because the women's organizations for these churches was always bring out the best of their food and sandwiches and stuff. And after the service, which the boys did, they sang most enthusiastically, were always invited to the spread. And, you know, young fellows running, because nobody ever walked in Cornwallis doing working hours. Every class moving from one period to another were required to move at the double in a seaman-like manner. And of course, there were lots of physical training, and they were fed fairly well, but they would go through this feast like a bunch of locusts. And sometime later on, we had a fairly close liaison with the local church, and sometime later on, the padre of Clementsport Church, the rector of Clementsport Church, he came out to me and he said, you know the old church? And I only knew it vaguely, that there were two Anglican churches, one up on the hill that was used as a museum, and the other one which he looked after. And he said, we have an annual service in the old church every year. He said, do you think the choir could attend and sing? I said, why, sure. I said, is there anything particularly you want to sing? He said, well, as a matter of fact, there is. He said, do you know the Dutch national hymn of Thanksgiving? I said, no, never heard of it. So he hummed it. Well, I knew the tune right away. And I said, oh, yes, I know that. I said, you got any music for it? I said, we'll sing it. So he handed, sure enough, he had a sheet of music for it. And I said, oh, we can handle this. I looked it through. And so there's just one thing, though. He said, I would like to sing it in Dutch. I said, what the hell for? So I said, well, he said, originally this church, this was a very, very poor area, and it was the church was built jointly by, and it, the area was settled by Scots, English, and Dutch from the American Wars, I believe. And they hadn't enough money to build separate churches, so they agreed to build the one church and share its services. Well, over the many years, the Dutch population either moved away, died out, or intermarried, and they finally decided that you know, there was no use them continue with the church, and so they decided to deed it to the Anglicans on the condition that an anniversary service be held every year, and at it be sung the Dutch national hymn of Thanksgiving. So I said, well, what do they do about singing it in Dutch? He said, well, there was always some Dutch girl around here, or some Dutch person who was singing there, and they used to sing it there. And he said, we haven't any. So I said, okay, we'll have a go. Well, I had a dickens of a job trying to get the words of this hymn in Dutch. We had a Dutch seamstress, a DP, a displaced person, in the base, who worked for the supply officer in the clothing business to alter uniforms, a Dutch seamstress. And I went down to her with this thing and tried to get a translation, but her English wasn't good enough, and my listening to... We didn't make much of a go at it. So finally, through the Bishop of Nova Scotia, who'd been to a synod in Holland, I got a copy of a Dutch hymn book, and from it I got the actual words, and I went back again to this seamstress, and of course with the written Dutch, she was okay, and she gave me the translation word by word, and I wrote it out phonetically, and so I taught the troops. I said, "Well, you've got to learn this. You've got to learn this tune." Now we learnt the tune first, and then I surprised them with this "Wilt heen u dreden burgor den heera," and we learnt it, and then it became our anthem. We sang it many, many times. Well, as you know, Cornwallis really was a place that seemed to inspire people who visited it. There was an air of bustle, business, and, dare I say, efficiency about it. I used to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I entered the gate exactly at 6:30, and by gosh, if the officer of the watch wasn't there fully shaved and dressed, along with his chief or petty officer. And from there I went down to the galley, and watched the breakfast being issued out to the men. And I did that every day I was in the establishment. The only thing, I would have a cup of coffee, that's all I would have there. And I would watch to make sure that everything was okay. And because we were catered to by a civilian organization, initiated in from Ontario, and they sent a manager down who recruited local civilians and cooks, and they did the cooking, that's how it was done. Consequently, we never had any need for cooks. But finally, one was drafted to us, one by the name of Chief Petty Officer Dark. I hadn't met him before, but he really was a remarkable man. And he had all the qualities of... He came to us from the leadership course, of which I'll talk a little more later. And he was... And every chief or petty officer in the place, if he wasn't supply, but the only people that... Supplies and writers were the only people that didn't engage in new entry training. But all others... Now, Dark was given... We had use for a cook in the galley, so he was given a division, and he was a crackerjack. Had all the qualities of leadership you required, and he even eventually took battalion drill, which I'm sure would tickle your heart. Let me see, I was going on to something else now. I'll just stop for a minute. Oh yes, due to the Korean War, they found out that there was an additional need for leadership among them. It was felt that there was probably an outcome of the Mingy Report, the need for leadership training of chiefs and petty officers. And so I was sent for by Kenny Dyer, I think it was, in Ottawa, and I was told that we were to start a leadership school, a course for chiefs and petty officers in Cornwallis, and that I was to go to England to survey all forms of leadership courses there, and to come back and get it organized in Cornwallis. And I was told that I could have any lieutenant commander in the Navy that I wanted for this job. Well, shortly after we'd opened Cornwallis, in fact, within 3 months, less than 3 months, was the bicentennial in Halifax. And the flag officer, who by then was Rollo Mingy, they sent us a message and asked for Cornwallis's participation. What could we do? And so I had a yarn with my PNRT officer, Clem Pettit. And having seen many a royal tournament and one thing and another, and seen the Air Force do physical jerks to music, I thought, well, gosh, this, in the short time that we had to our notice, I thought that this would be the best. I thought of teaching them the hornpipe, but I couldn't find a proper instructor, and it was just as well I didn't, because the Sheffield was in, and she had a bunch of young seamen do the hornpipe on parade ground in the dockyard. And so what we did, at evening quarters for 2 months, every man jack in the place was falling in for evening quarters, and with the PNRT staff of three, Pettit and two Springers, we, and the band, we taught them aerobics, I suppose it was, to music. And it was summertime, and so I ordered that at all recreational activities, and even physical training that came in through their daily effort, the new entries were to be encouraged to strip to the waist. I wanted them all tanned. And so we went on to this, and consequently, evening quarters, instead of lasting a few minutes, always lasted half an hour. And I insisted that everybody do it, officers as well as chiefs and petty officers. And there are a few of them that grumbled about it, and they grumbled that, I'm over 35, and I said, well, I'm over 40, and if I can do it, you can. So democracy was the order of the day, and we all did it. And eventually, mind you, behind every activity, I had the fullest confidence and support of my captain. He was a wonderful guy. And so we shipped them all up to Cornwallis, and they made arrangements to billet them. And when they went to breakfast in the morning, there I was in the galley making sure, although it wasn't my province, there I was. So, and we had them, and they were beautifully tanned by this time, and we had them in the old rink down below, and they marched up the hill onto the parade ground in fours, and all dressed in white with white sneakers, white shorts, and white singlets. And they marched in the PT manner, you know, instead of the fingers clenched with the thumb, they were extended in a straight manner, extended straight, as they did on in PNRT. And I must say it was damn impressive. And they marched on and to allocated spots on the parade ground, 200 of them, and they carried out this whole 15-20 minute drill to music. Clem Petter organized it very, very well. We had a standby group in case any man collapsed, and on one or two occasions it did happen, the man collapsed, and the smooth, effortless way somebody took his place and the victim was carried away was impressive. And I got a sneaking feeling that there were occasions when old Clem detailed again, you fainted, exercise, so and so and so and so, because it was done so smoothly. Anyway, the guy in charge of the whole operation was Scruffy O'Brien. Now, Scruffy and I had met before when I was in Ontario and he was in Crescent. And I didn't know a great deal about him, but I was certainly impressed by him and the manner in which he organized and conducted this dockyard, more or less Navy Week it was. Yes, it was. It was a Navy Week for the bicentennial. And So when Kenny Dyer said, "Who do you want?" I said, "Scruffy O'Brien." Scruffy O'Brien. Because we were sitting on the top of the Stadacona building watching them, and with Scruff, and old Scruff said, "Well, I wouldn't mind working down at that place." And I remembered this, so when Kenny said, "Who do you want?" I elected for Scruffy O'Brien. I couldn't have picked anybody better because he had that delightful sense of a humor. Very, very clever man, intelligent, beyond the average, and his sense of humor, as you know, is worth a wagon load of workmen. So he and I got a plane, and we went off to England. And Cappy wouldn't let me stay away too long. I was hoping to make a bit of a holiday of it, but no, sir, he wanted us back, both. So we went over, and we toured. We went to Port Royal Arthur. I couldn't think of the name. That's where the Duke of Edinburgh was at a pier. And they showed us around. They had a very extensive and capable leadership course going on in there. We went to Plymouth and looked around there, and we went to Portsmouth. And I said, "Well, I'd like to see over Whale Island." I had a bit of an affection for old Whaley, and so we went over there, and we were being shown through a place by a lieutenant commander, and the Marine Band was carrying out its exercises, practicing rather. And old Scruff said, "Look, there's a piece of music that I'd like to get, and we should, the RCN should, their band, our band, to play." I said, "What's it called?" He said, "I don't know." I said, "Well, let's ask the Marine Bandmaster." So we got hold of the Marine Bandmaster, who was most accommodating. And Scruff said to him, "There's a piece of music we'd like to play in Canada that you people play, but I don't know what name it is." So he said, "It goes like this, and it was this regimental march of the Queen's Royal Regiment that they gave Wayline permission. It's 1794 officers of the men of the Queen's Second Regiment of Foot. The Queen's Royal Regiment were embarked on board HMS Queen Charlotte, since renamed Excellent, and took part in the Battle of the Glorious 1st of June. A few years ago, the Queen's 2nd Regiment of Foot, the Queen's Royal Regiment, granted permission to HMS Excellent to use their regimental march Braganza on ceremonial occasions." So Scruff whistled it, he hummed this tune for him, and he said, "Oh," the bandmaster said, "Yes, we know that, that's from so-and-so and so-and-so." And he said, "I'll send you a copy." And by God, he kept his word. And the music came out. And the first time I ever heard it played in Canada was played on Cornwallis Parade Ground by old Mickey Dole and his band. So we came back, and Scruff set up the organization for leadership courses, and away we went. And as you know, you came down and had a very, very abridged section with Ralph Hennessy's group, which I must say was a very, very enjoyable occasion to us to have such a group visit us. And I think they went away and spread the word about Cornwallis, because we never lacked visitors after that. I'll never forget old Cappy Musgrave detailing Ralph Hennessy to preach the sermon, and but Moore gave him the verse and chapter from which to preach from, and of course old Ralph Hennessy came through, and he did a wonderful, wonderful job. Well, Cornwallis was one of the highlights of my career. I even hated to go on leave from the place in case somebody interfered with it whilst I was away. And most people that I've met since always have happy recollections of it, those who were trained there and those who served there, both officers and men. And I'd say they're pretty well 3 years, I think it was, and the news of my departure came in rather an unusual fashion. Harold Grant was chief of naval staff at the time, and he was about to retire and was visiting the commands to say his goodbyes. And he, a captain, and Mrs. Musgrave, and myself and my wife were over at the captain's house, having a little chat after cocktails, and suddenly Harold Grant said, I suppose you've heard where you're going to, Budge, eh? And all of us, our mouths dropped open because we'd heard not a damn thing. And Kathy, I don't think, was particularly keen on seeing me go. And we all waited to hear with bated breath where I was to go. And Harold said, Oh, well, I'm talking to the ship's company tomorrow, he said, and I'll tell you, you'll hear it then. And so the next day, at evening quarters, we got a lectern out. He always liked a lectern for any comments that he had to make. He talked to the ship's company, and at the end he said to them, now I expect you'd all like to know where your executive officer is going. He said, we're commissioning a ship, a cruiser, a training cruiser, to take you people and see to train you. He said, and Commander Budge will get command of her. She is to be HMCS Quebec, the ex-Uganda. And that's the way I heard that I was to be Command Quebec. There was one other thing. We had a PNRT there in Cornwallis who had a crow that he'd rescued from damage. And this damn crow really became a sailor's crow. His name was Joe. And there wasn't a single muster of sailors that he didn't tend. And it was a good training for them, because he would try to undo their shoelaces and one thing and another whilst they were standing at attention. And they were, of course, required not even to look at him, but to stand from, much to the amusement of everybody. And one day we were at divisions, and we stuck by the old Navy routine of prayers every morning, evening quarters at night. And this morning, the chain running around the dais, Harry Plowman would just say in the prayers, and this blasted crow jumped on the head of an ordinary seaman. We were off caps, with our heads bowed, and old Joe, in front of everybody, just flew on top and landed on this guy's head while poor old Harry could continue the prayers. On another occasion, we just finished prayers, and Joe was perched on the chain in front of that hung around the dais, and I was just going to say, call the parade to attention, to report them to Cappy to carry on with the business of the day, and I said, parade! And Joe went, ah! Almost like the executive order, and that again reduced the people to a bunch of laughter. We used to have fun in Cornwallis. Anyway, it came so that I finally left, and my biggest, saddest parting was with the choir, and I found that most difficult because it had provided me with a relationship with the ordinary seamen that I would not otherwise have had. I'd learnt a lot from Mickey Noll, and we were at Middleton High School participating in their final thing, I tried to make a little speech to the choir, and I couldn't. I left. But there was one happening there with the choir. In Halifax, Marjorie Payne, the famous organist and choir conductor, had a group called Harmony Harbour, and for years they would sing beautiful sea shanties on Sunday afternoon, and I learnt many a sea shanty from them. And they were to do the broadcast from Cornwallis. They'd never broadcast outside their station before, but they wanted to give a sort of nautical atmosphere. Well, the producer of the show was a guy named Kennedy, and he came down a week beforehand, and I'd been teaching the choir and one or two more sea shanties, because I felt this was part of their kit. And so for the week, I bugged this Mr. Kennedy about participating with the choir. And finally, he reluctantly agreed. Now, the theme song of this group was Shenandoah, which they sang beautifully. And so I trained the boys in Shenandoah, and we were to sing separately. I ain't never seen the like since I've been born, a blink back me with the sea boots on, when Johnny come down to Hilo, poor old Joe. And another one, away, haul away, away, haul away the bowling. And so we grouped the two choirs, because the RCs came in with an enormous crowd. I must confess that we sang their theme song with them, and I was a little unsatisfied with it, because they sang it. I was on the stage with this group of four, and we did it in the canteen theater, in the theater. And I was beaten time for